This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, you're with Extra with me, Geraldine Doogue, bringing you just some of the people and the stories that excite me each week. So, great to have your company for the next half hour. First to the story that has really been one of the biggest for quite some time, the disappearance and probable murder of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi in that country's consulate in Turkey this week. It certainly raised some very dark questions, particularly among reform-minded Saudis, but others looking on as well. And it looks as if there may be evidence of his death yet to publicly emerge. According to US and Turkish officials, the Turkish government has told the US it has audio and video recordings to prove that Jamal Khashoggi was tortured and killed inside the Saudi embassy. Now, this is just the latest extremely vivid incident to emerge from Saudi Arabia. It's worth remembering the sequence of events over the last 18 months or so. First, there was what became known as the Ritz-Carlton purge, if you recall, of about 300 princes who were suddenly detained in a range of luxury hotels. But we now find some of them were tortured and there were certainly amounts of money were extracted from them. Then there was the detention of the Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. There was the very strong diplomatic spat with Canada and the arrest and execution of the Saudi Shia cleric Salman al-Auda. And of course, Khashoggi's appearance is just the latest in this rather extraordinary list. So what do we make of it in terms of what's happening inside Saudi Arabia? And will it change the whole nature of Middle East politics? To shed some light on this, we're joined now from London by Dr. Neil Quilliam. He's a senior research fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Good morning.
Good morning.
That sequence of events, in a way, are by far the most dramatic. But, gee, it's been revving up, hasn't it, for a while?
It really has. And I think analysts, think tank community, and certainly policymakers and journalists, you know, have been watching this. It's almost been like a very slow car crash happening. Even for people, you know, that have sort of been willing Saudi Arabia to reform and wanting it to change. I mean, you know, things sort of looked quite positive for a short period of time after Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, sort of, you know, rose to prominence. But those events that you've highlighted, the Ritz-Carlton, crisis with Qatar, war in Yemen, even sort of before
yes,
he really
I didn't,
sort
I didn't
of came
name
to the,
those.
Even before he came to the forefront in January 2016, Nimr al-Nimr, the sort of, you know, prominent activist, dissident Shia cleric in the Eastern Province, was, you know, prosecuted and executed. I mean, in a way, that did send quite a shock, I think, to most of us, and that should have been a clear signal. But we've had these key events over the past sort of 18 months, up to Khashoggi, and I guess we can all see what this is now for what it really is.
Well, what is it in your view?
I mean, you have a young leader here who is intent on bringing about reform, but reform sort of in the economic sphere, opening up to a certain extent some of the sort of, you know, the social environment, but absolutely brooking no dissidents, no opposition, not dissidents, but no opposition to his project. He really wants to drive this project forward. I mean, we've seen a consolidation of power primarily into his hands or into the hands of a few, distinct concentration. And the marginalization of all opposition. When I say opposition, I don't mean those people in the streets. I mean those who might just be opposing or even sort of advising to take an alternative path.
Now, I'm going to come back to that, but let's just talk a little bit more about this man, this Jamal Khashoggi. He is very interesting in that he was no dissident. He initially expressed quite a lot of support for the young leader. He'd been writing for the Washington Post for the past year in self-imposed exile. And now there was a very interesting piece in the London Spectator by John Bradley, who knew him very well, who'd worked for 30 years in the Middle East, working for The Economist and others, who had a sort of different take on him again, suggesting that in fact he was really a very influential Islamist very much of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that he wasn't this sort of liberal whom the West has, because of his work with the Washington Post, has cared to present.
Well, I mean, first I should say I think a lot of us have sort of worked with him, or at least, you know, engaged with him. So I mean, he's very well known. He's been very active. Sort of,
2 million Twitter followers.
That's right. At Chatham House, we've engaged with him. He's taken part in a lot of our workshops. He's done the same with a lot of think tanks, actually, all over the world. So this almost feels very personal because we've all got to know him very well. And yes, we have sort of seen, you know, him sort of, I guess, transition from being more of a sort of Brotherhood supporter. I mean, I did read that article, and, you know, we do have to draw a very clear distinction between what the Muslim Brotherhood is as a political party and more extreme groups. I mean, it is not an extremist group in the sense that so many consider. But yes, he was sympathetic to the Brotherhood and to its goals, but he's also, I guess you could argue, he was on a journey. He became more of a nationalist, and towards the end, I mean, I don't want to say towards the end, I'm hoping he's still around, more liberal in his views. I mean, that's just a shift and a change in his views. He was never extreme in his views, though.
Well, I mean, you know, President al-Sisi from Egypt wouldn't agree with you about the Muslim Brotherhood, but this is so complicated in terms of Middle East politics as to who aligns with whom.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what's very clear and what we've seen over the past, you know, couple of years, and you know, essentially coming out of the end of the sort of the Arab uprising period, is that whilst there is a complexity there, leaders in the region, certainly in Saudi Arabia, certainly in the Emirates, certainly in Egypt, as you've alluded to, President Sisi, see situations black or white. You're either with us, you're against us. Mm. Either you're running with our kind of secular project, and our secular sounds a little bit strange in Saudi Arabia, but our secular project, or your Brotherhood, which means you're out, or your pro-Iran, which means you're out. So almost that kind of, you know, George Bush moment, with us or against us.
Mm. Dr. Neil Quilliam's my guest from the Chatham House program, and we're talking about this amazing story about the disappearance of the Saudi journalist. There is a suggestion that he could have been setting himself up as an opponent to the Crown Prince. I think he'd set himself up, again, according to that article, a new party in America called Democracy for the Arab World Now, and some kind of power struggle. Now, is this a possibility, or is this an unconscionable suggestion?
I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, he would be seen as a centre or as a pole of some form of opposition party that was going to lead some form of movement against, you know, the Saudi ruling family or against Mohammed bin Salman specifically. Yes, he may be in a pole for academics, for activists outside the country, just a centre figure who could sort of feed in maybe philosophically. But certainly, I mean, I can't imagine at all that he would have an ambition, you know, to build a party, mobilize, get on the ground in Saudi Arabia and lead some form of major change. That just does not bode well.
Why on earth would he have gone into that embassy? I mean, he'd exiled himself in America. He was telling people like Tom Friedman from the New York Times that there was a dark side to MBS, that he had a whole lot of hardliners around him, that it wasn't safe for him to go back, even though the Crown Prince allegedly pleaded with him a few months back. So, well, why on earth did he say yes?
I mean, Saudi Arabia had never been Saddam Hussein's Iraq, had never been Hafiz al-Assad's Syria, or never had been, you know, Iran, where you would be whisked away from a consulate. Saudi Arabia has always provided, you know, a sort of off-ramp, if you like, for dissidents. And again, you know, we keep saying he wasn't a dissident. So he probably went, yes, he was probably fearful, but probably went there in good faith thinking, well, Saudi Arabia does not operate like this. There's a slight risk. I'm naturally going to be concerned, but would have had no idea, you know, that either he would be sort of bundled into a car and whisked off, or he wouldn't have imagined that would happen. Or certainly, if the fate that we begin to think has happened, would certainly not have thought that. This really strongly suggests that if this has really happened, you know, the MO, the modus operandi of Saudi Arabia has changed significantly.
I understand many Saudi nationals are trying to renew second passports to get out, and the UN has reported that direct foreign investment has fallen in the past 2 years, really quite dramatically, from $7.5 billion down to $1.5 billion after international companies sold stakes in local businesses. This is surely going to have a devastating effect on Saudi Arabia itself, isn't it?
No, I don't think it will be a flash in the pan. I strongly suspect that Mohammed bin Salman would have thought, you know, given that he's got the green light, given that, you know, okay, there are some bumps in the road, but we can push ahead with this. But I think, I mean, those figures you refer to in terms of investment, inward investment is absolutely critical for the, you know, for the Saudi economy as it wants to, you know, realize Saudi 2030, as it needs to diversify and as it needs to address this, you know, demographic time bomb, if you like. Mm. It has no choice other than to do that.
Dr. Neil Quilliam, thank you very much indeed for bringing us all that depth of understanding to bear. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Neil Quilliam, a senior research fellow with the Mideast and North Africa program at Chatham House. I don't think that story's over yet.
On RN, you're listening to Extra, the best of Saturday's show with me, Geraldine Duke.
You might recall that last week it was reported that the recently ex-Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull had represented us at a couple of United Nations events. It was reported that he and Lucy Turnbull had unusually been granted overseas travel entitlements by the new Prime Minister Scott Morrison, although Mr. Turnbull has said he won't be claiming any taxpayer expenses for his New York trip. He did two duties on behalf of Australia, though, both speeches at the UN headquarters. One of them was for Tobacco-Free Portfolios, whose founder and CEO, Dr. Bronwyn King, a Melbourne-based oncologist, joins us now.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Now, just to be clear, the UN General Assembly was on, but this event of yours was not part of that. Is that right?
Well, the official language, and I've had to learn a lot of things about language at the UN in the last few months. So the official way to describe our event was it was a high-level side event held on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly.
Okay.
It took me about 6 months to learn how to say that, but that is official protocol for the UN.
But it did mean there were a few influential people in town.
Well, that's why we had it then. So a lot of people who are trying to do all sorts of things have events during the UN General Assembly because all of the world leaders are in town and there is a good chance that you'll get some of them to come to your event. And so that was our strategy and it did work.
Yes, and this is part of a strategy we'll hear, that we'll hear about. And before you tell us about the New York event and another one happening in Sydney next week, tell us briefly about yourself and your organisation. How did it come about for those who don't know the story?
Well, I'm an oncologist from Melbourne and my very first experiences in medicine were working on the lung cancer ward at Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre. That was back in 2001. And despite living in this beautiful country with access to great medicine, nearly all of my patients on the lung cancer ward died. And it was a very confronting thing to be a young doctor hoping to help people, but to see the true impact of tobacco right there in front of my eyes every day. And then 10 years later, it was just an accidental discovery that occurred, which was that I found out that my compulsory superannuation fund was investing some of my money in tobacco companies. And to me, that just made absolutely no sense. So from that point onwards, I started to engage with the finance sector, first of all in Australia and then globally, to ask finance leaders to reconsider tobacco and to stand alongside the health sector and governments globally and be part of the solution when it comes to global tobacco control. And by doing that, I mean stopping investing in tobacco, stopping lending money to tobacco companies and no longer insuring them.
Oh, no, I think that was 5 years ago, wasn't it? And for the past 3 years, you have been roaming the globe when you're not seeing patients, trying to convince financial leaders and investors not to invest. Have you found them open to this or resistant?
Well, it depends on where I am. There are some countries where finance leaders are incredibly welcoming and very keen to learn more and really dive into the issue and reconsider what they're currently doing with tobacco. So in France, our work has been very successful. The biggest bank in France is BNP Paribas, the big French bank, and last year made a decision to no longer lend money, invest money, or insure tobacco companies. And AXA, which is one of the biggest insurers in the world, Paris-based, made that decision in 2016. And both of those decisions were billion-dollar decisions. And not only did those companies make those decisions, but the leaders of those companies, in fact, joined our Global Advisory Council and have helped us expand the work. So they really mean business in France, and it's been great to see the change that's been happening there. But also the Netherlands has been very responsive to this conversation, and I have a colleague who's based in London who does a lot of work across Europe, and she's been very successful in working with big financial organisations in the Netherlands, and about 15 of them have implemented tobacco-free finance policies in the past couple of years. In other places, it's tough. In the USA and in the UK, it's very difficult. These conversations are very green and very, very, you know, really in the early phases.
And what do they say by comparison with the Netherlands and France?
Well, it's just a new conversation for them. So we just have to go right back to the start and bring them along the journey. And everybody does come along the journey. It's very hard to do nothing when you're informed of the true facts around tobacco and the impact it's having on the community. So the World Health Organization predicts that the world's on track for 1 billion tobacco deaths this century. That's an incredible statistic. 1 billion. There's only 7 billion of us.
See, I would have thought it wouldn't. I'm a little surprised because I would have thought by now it wouldn't look good to invest in tobacco, and because of this, your corporate image think of. But clearly that's not the case for some people. I mean, what do they say about why they think it's still reasonable?
I don't think they do think it's reasonable. I just think they're not ready to move yet. And so there are many sort of concerns or potential complexities or barriers that financial organisations bring up. And we have dealt with those in all around the world. We've had an impact now in more than 12 countries with about 100 financial organisations. So we're very familiar with those potential barriers, but there are solutions that can be employed to get through those concerns. And eventually, I'm very optimistic that finance leaders in the USA and the UK will come on board. But
and what about here, by the way? How many super funds still invest here?
Well, it's better to think of it as the other way around. So there's 45 major Australian super funds that are now tobacco-free, and they control around about 1.3 trillion Australian dollars. So it's the majority of money in Australian superannuation that's now tobacco-free. And we are still engaged with others that haven't quite got there yet, but they're coming along much more quickly than they used to.
And look, let me ask this. Do they say to you, look, we're going to try to stay and help investigate better quality tobacco or something? I mean, in other words, we're in there because we think that that's the best way to do less harm. I mean, how do you answer that?
So some financial organisations say that they want to employ the strategy of engagement, where they sit down with tobacco companies and try to encourage them to do better things. Now, I have to say, in Australia, no one says that, really. I just haven't heard anybody try to use that as an argument. Overseas, people do sometimes use that as an argument. And I was quite taken aback when I first heard of that, because I thought, gosh, what on earth do you do? And I remember sitting in London in this major financial organisation actually saying to people, but what do you mean you engage with them? What happens? And they promptly responded with, oh, well, since our engagement has occurred, they've appointed an extra woman to the board. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. Okay, what else? And then they said, well, they're more transparent in their CEO compensation information, or they have improved their audit accountability. And whilst all of that is nice, none of that deals with the fact that tobacco companies make products that kill people. And that is the issue.
So with you, you're either in or you're out. Is that
correct?
What the message?
Yeah. You're in or you're out. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. If you invest in a company, you want that company to grow and succeed and thrive. And that is not what the world needs when it comes to tobacco.
So back to the UN event where you launched this tobacco-free finance pledge. Now, what's the idea of that?
Well, the idea of the pledge is to really shine a spotlight on the leading financial organisations all around the world that have already considered this issue and moved to tobacco-free. We want to thank them because it's quite courageous of them to go first and do things differently. And we want to show that there are a huge number of mainstream financial organisations all around the world that have done this, and hopefully that will inspire other finance leaders to at least start the conversation and start the journey to tobacco-free finance.
That was the pledge in New York, and there's something new, isn't there, being launched this coming week?
Yeah, so a separate initiative that we're launching next week is a certification stamp for super funds, health funds, and also fund managers. It's a little bit like a Heart Foundation tick. And so they sign up to the program, they're subject to an audit, and if they are tobacco-free, they can put this certification stamp on their websites and in their materials so that their members and clients can be really sure that their money isn't being invested in tobacco companies. And now the name of that program is called Verified Tobacco-Free.
So can we see it? Like if we're sort of looking at investments, and particularly our compulsory super, if any of us bother to look at the our returns each year, can
well,
we see it?
Well, that's it. That's it. We want to make this more visible, because I get countless emails every single day from people in the general public saying, oh, look, could you just tell me, is my super fund tobacco free? And I feel like we need to improve the transparency for customers and for members. And so the aim of this is that when super funds sign up and pass the audit, that they can then display this proudly on their websites or in the brochures that come out to members all the time, so that members can find out really easily. It shouldn't be up to a member to have to look through a product disclosure statement on page 50 to find out that their money isn't being invested in tobacco.
You know, you're a bit of a tornado, Brom, and after New York, you went off to Europe, let alone come back here for this verified tobacco-free stamp. How many presentations did you give in Europe, for instance?
Well, this journey was actually, this was a 3-week trip that I've just been on with 6 stops in 3 different continents, taking in all sorts of different things. So I was at the annual conference for the International Forum for Sovereign Wealth Funds. I had some meetings in Amsterdam, meetings in Paris, a whole series of things in New York surrounding the UN event. And then I went to the Conference of the Parties of the UN Tobacco Control Treaty. That was in Geneva last week, which was a fascinating conference to see. And then I went to a very small but super high-level conference in, it seemed to be in the middle of nowhere in Austria. It was at this tiny little town in Austria, but it was filled with European health ministers and heads of health departments. And so it was absolutely fantastic to be able to meet many of those health ministers and to make some plans about how we might collaborate and move forwards together.
Goodness me. Did you imagine yourself having this level of ambition when you started out in medicine?
Oh, look, the last few years has been unimaginable, really, especially this UN event. It was just incredible. To make it happen, you actually have to have 2 governments officially co-sponsor the event. And so this year I was super lucky to meet the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, who introduced me to his health minister, and she came to our event, which was wonderful. We also had the health minister of the Netherlands come to our event and speak there, and he's become a good friend of ours in just the past couple of weeks, and we're looking forward to working with him and his team as we move forwards. But also I had many trips up to Canberra, and I was very happy that Mr. Turnbull, when he was Prime Minister, signed off and agreed to co-sponsor the event, and it was very kind of him to come and speak at the event 2 weeks ago, and I think that really helped raise the profile of what we were doing.
I just have to let listeners know your great little mantra that you told me before we started talking about what your attitude to life is.
Oh, well, I was saying that you're going to make me say my silly quote here, but that's all right. My life has become crazy, and I'm always so busy and I'm all over the place. But I do have this theory that if you want to change the world, you can't stay at home in your pajamas. You have to get out there and have these conversations. And these conversations need to be had outside of Australia. And it's a very unfortunate thing that it takes us so long to get anywhere. But we just have to deal with it, get on the plane and go and meet people and try to push things forwards.
Get out of those pyjamas. All right. Look, Bronwyn, fabulous to hear from you, and congratulations. Keep going.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. Okay. It's been really great to have so much support from all across Australia.
Bronwyn King, a dynamo, Melbourne-based oncologist, founder and CEO of Tobacco Free Portfolios. One of our texters has said, Bronwyn, sugar and cancer, too early for the conversation? Well, I suspect so. I'm Geraldine Doogue. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week or online via the RN website.